It is June 14th, 1838. The steamship Pulaski has just departed Charleston, South Carolina, bound for Baltimore, Maryland. On board the luxury steamer, the wealthy Southern elite enjoy all the Pulaski has to offer. They mingle over cocktails and cigars, play cards, and discuss business. Rebecca Lamar is the sister of the ship's controlling owner, Gazaway Lamar. Her brother had pleaded with her to take a vacation north with him and his family to a luxury resort. Rebecca had a strong fear of the ocean, especially in light of the recent tragedy of the steamer Home just the year prior. But Miss Lamar wished to visit a close friend in the north, and so agreed to join him. It was a fine day, although the wind had been picking up throughout the morning. After finishing afternoon tea, Rebecca and another passenger, a Miss Parkman, made their way to the upper deck. Strolling along, taking in the salty ocean air, the two women stopped next to two small, pathetic-looking boats covered with a tarp. Peeking under the tarp at the boats, Miss Parkman exclaimed, "In the event of an accident, I'd prefer clinging to the steamer than to get into one of them. The sea may have opened the seams and caused them to leak." But despite her prior fears of ocean travel, Miss Lamar was nonplussed. As soon as she boarded the impressive Pulaski, she felt secure and safe. Danger was the last thing on her mind. After a lovely evening, good company, and a fine meal, passengers lingered for a short time before retiring to their cabins. It was not a long trip, and the ship was due to arrive in Baltimore by morning. But instead of a good night's sleep, they would soon get the shock of their lives. The steamship Pulaski, today, on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventure. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. Thank you so much for listening. Steam-powered vessels date back to the 18th century, with upgrades and innovations gradually taking shape. Improvements by the Scottish inventor James Watt made the steam engine practical, leading to the proliferation of steam-powered ships into the 20th century. But these technological advances came with significant risk. Much like today's shipping companies, steamboat operators wanted to make money. Traveling faster and carrying more people and cargo resulted in higher profits. In an age with little to no regulation, steamboat engineers often fed the boilers more and more fuel to achieve higher speeds. The high pressure of the overloaded boilers was far beyond boiler design and the science of metallurgy of the time, causing countless fires and boiler explosions on early steam vessels. One such accident was the steamboat Heroine, which was destroyed in 1835 when its boiler exploded, leaving several dead and many others severely wounded. On October 9, 1837, the steam packet Home was traveling from New York to Charleston, South Carolina, when it drifted onto the shoals near Ocracoke Island. Swells from an approaching hurricane damaged the ship, extinguished its boilers, and wrecked the ship entirely. 95 people perished, and the disaster made the traveling public rather skeptical, if not outright distrustful, of traveling by steamship. In 1838, the boiler on the steamboat Moselle exploded on the Ohio River near Cincinnati, killing 150 of the 280 people on board. From 1830 to 1839, 272 steamboats in the United States were destroyed by mechanical failure or explosion. Between 1810 and 1850, roughly 4,000 deaths can be attributed to steamboat accidents. The worst maritime disaster in U.S. history occurred in 1865 when the sidewheel paddle steamer Sultana exploded on the Mississippi River, killing close to 1,500 people, most of them Union soldiers. The story of the Sultana is told in episodes 1 and 2 of Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Exploding boilers and raging fires on steamboats like these got public attention and generated an outcry over the lack of regulation of the steamboat industry. Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections: Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections: Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. The steamship Pulaski was built in Baltimore in 1837 at the shipyard of John A. Robb for the Savannah and Charleston Steam Packet Company. She was named in honor of Casimir Pulaski, a Polish military commander who fought to defend his home country against foreign aggression. Benjamin Franklin later recommended Pulaski to George Washington to help the upstart Continental Army fight for their independence from Great Britain. Washington made Pulaski a general in the Continental Army, and the Polish commander reformed a floundering United States cavalry, and General Pulaski even saved General Washington's life at the Battle of Brandywine. Pulaski was wounded during the Siege of Savannah in 1779. And later died from his wounds. The steamship named after him was a luxury vessel meant for the wealthy and elite. Its normal route was between Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, and Baltimore, Maryland. Newspaper advertisements at the time boasted of the ship's 225-horsepower engine, copper boilers, and the spacious and luxurious accommodations for passengers. The Pulaski was quite a sight for her time. At 203 feet long, 25 feet wide, elegant cabins, lounges, and dining, and it attracted some of the most prominent families up and down the east coast of the United States. Snowbirds escaped to Savannah during the winter, while Savannah's elite headed to swanky resorts in the north to escape the sticky, humid summers of the American South. With the destruction of the steamship home in recent memory, the Pulaski was also built for strength, seaworthiness, and speed. She was powered by two side paddle wheels, with two masts for optional wind power when needed. On June 13, 1838, the Pulaski set out on just her fourth voyage, carrying 90 passengers and 37 crew from Savannah and reached Charleston later that afternoon. The ship was under the command of Captain J. Davis Dubois, along with sailing master Captain Pearson. After an overnight stay in Charleston, 65 additional passengers boarded, bringing the total on board to 192. Not surprisingly, the passenger list included an assortment of wealthy Americans. Many brought their children, maids, nannies, and servants, and in some cases, enslaved persons. Along with many other prominent families, principal owner of the ship, Gazaway B. Lamar, was on board, along with his wife Jane, five of their six children, his sister Rebecca Lamar, his niece, and nanny. With these affluent passengers came their valuables. Jewelry, cash, bonds, pocket watches, and other valuables were packed away in trunks and luggage and taken on the voyage. On the morning of June 14th, the Pulaski departed Charleston for Baltimore. The weather was warm and clear, but a strong east wind soon developed, causing rough seas. Captain Dubois was mindful of staying clear of the dangerous shoals of the Outer Banks of North Carolina and took the Pulaski east into the open Atlantic. The steamship chugged north through the rough seas, causing the engines to work harder. When the engines work harder, the boilers need to work harder too. And boilers need coal. The Pulaski's second engineer labored over the ship's boilers, feeding them with more and more coal to keep the paddle wheels churning. When the boiler's water supply reached a surprisingly low level, the second engineer panicked and opened the valve which allowed cold seawater to rush into the red-hot copper boiler. The result was catastrophic. The cold seawater was flash steamed, and the sudden high pressure built up inside the starboard boiler unleashed a massive explosion. The starboard side of the vessel amidships was utterly destroyed, along with a portion of the promenade deck and the wheelhouse above. The blast also crushed in the bulkhead between the boilers and the forward cabins, and blocked the stairs leading up to them. Captain Dubois was blown from the wheelhouse, and he was never seen again. The blast had produced massive amounts of scalding hot, high-pressure steam to burst forth in all directions. Those caught in its blast were essentially incinerated or horrendously scalded. Others were blown 100 feet or more into the air and out into the open sea. Red-hot copper shrapnel and razor-sharp shards of wood were turned into deadly projectiles. An estimated 90 people were killed in the initial blast. Those who were thrown into the water were forced into a desperate struggle to find something, anything, to hold onto. Everything from broken planks to small sofas were used as flotation devices. Anyone fortunate enough to remain on the Pulaski faced going down with a quickly sinking ship. The stern section of the Pulaski housed the women and children, and it was now underwater up to the promenade deck. Only a broken and mangled midsection barely remained connecting to the ship's bow. Rebecca Lamar was asleep in her cabin with her nieces when the boat exploded. Awakened by what she compared to a thunderbolt, she and her nieces were jolted awake in confusion and panic. The shockwave of the blast caused a bed to block the door, but it was soon jolted away as the ship rolled and convulsed. Sounds of the ship groaning and creaking, combined with blood-curdling screams of suffering, added to their terror. Lamar found her sister-in-law Jane, four nephews, an infant, and the family nurse in the passageway, and hurried for the main deck. In the chaos, she found her brother Gazaway. "What is the matter?" she asked. Pale, trembling, and panicked, Mr. Lamar exclaimed, "The boiler has burst, the boat is sinking, and we will be lost in 5 minutes." Rebecca and Jane held on to the children desperately as a crowd of people surged toward the upper deck. A passenger shouted to Gazaway Lamar, "Mr. Lamar, save my children!" Gazaway, still panicked, shouted, "I will do what I can for you, but I have no hope for any of us." Rebecca Lamar, her family members, and other passengers scrambled to the upper deck. One of the lifeboats was stripped of its cover, turned into position, and prepared for launch as anxious passengers looked on. Suddenly, a horrible cry rang out, gaining the attention of Rebecca Lamar. She raced across the deck and discovered a woman desperately clinging to the side of the ship. With a heroic flash, she reached out, grasped the woman's arms, and hauled her back on the deck. Immediately, Miss Lamar dashed back to her family and found her niece Eliza and others already seated in the lifeboat. Seeing the small boat packed full of people, she recalled her conversation with Miss Parkman from just the day before and snatched her young niece Eliza up and out of the boat and said, "I wish to remain on the steamer." But after her brother Gazaway implored her to board the boat, she relented and squeezed in with the others, holding on to her niece tightly. Just at that moment, the steamer split apart amidships and horrible sounds of snapping, crunching wood could be heard. The jolting of the ship's stern capsized the lifeboat, and all within it were dumped into the cold, dark water. Rebecca was struck by a wave and knocked free of the boat. Grasping in the dark, she managed to get hold of a 10-foot plank from the ship and held on tight. Lying on her back, she floated into the stern of the ship and scrambled back up on the wreckage. Just moments later, Gazaway Lamar swam up to the stern section as well and climbed aboard, followed in succession by his daughter Martha and sons Willie and Charles. Fearing the waves would wash them off, they climbed even higher up on the wreckage. Just as they gained the additional altitude, the entire stern section broke apart and separated from the promenade deck. Rebecca Lamar once more found herself in the water, struggling for her life. As she dipped under the water over and over again, a feather pillow floated into her arms. It was a serendipitous life preserver. Lying on her back, she floated on the water again until finding her way back to the wreckage. Standing now on what remained of the promenade deck, she looked desperately for her loved ones. As some other passengers and crew found their way to this makeshift raft, she found her brother Gazaway and they embraced. Men began swimming up holding children, and Rebecca and her brother rushed to each one, hoping to find their family. Finally, a man arrived holding Gazaway's son Thomas, who fell asleep in Rebecca's arms. It was after midnight of June 15th, and a somber quiet settled over the scene. Out of the darkness, a man's voice bellowed, "Help! Help!" Someone replied, "We have no means to help you. Who are you?" "Colonel Ball, wife and daughter of Columbus, Georgia," the man answered. The voice then disappeared, never heard from again. As daylight broke, several ships could be seen passing in the distance, but with no method of signaling them, they continued on, making no notice of the wreckage. One of the ship's small boats drifted towards the promenade deck life raft and was secured. Surprisingly, it had no leaks and provided some hope. A champagne basket was also retrieved, containing two bottles of wine, a bottle of peppermint, and a vial of laudanum. The basket and its contents were given to Rebecca Lamar for safekeeping. Soon after, another boat approached, but this time with two men inside. One of the men suddenly jumped overboard and began swimming frantically. The other man stayed in the boat until it was up close to the wreckage, when he jumped into the water. A rope was thrown to him and he was pulled up to safety. The boat, which was larger than the first, was leaking badly. Several men did what they could to patch the boat and then secured it with a rope. As the day dragged on and the struggle to survive continued, a strange sight approached. A young man and young woman were clinging to two small sofas that had been lashed together, and the small boat that had been secured was sent out to retrieve the couple. Upon their return, the man was discovered to be nude, save for a small loincloth. Both collapsed into semi-consciousness. Rebecca Lamar used the peppermint oil on their lips in an attempt to wake them, but after a brief revival, the man slipped back into unconsciousness and died. The woman, however, regained her strength, and upon seeing Gazaway Lamar, whispered weakly, "Mr. Lamar, I saw your little boy this morning." Excited, Lamar exclaimed, "Charles?" "Yes, Charles. I called to him not to give up." "When did you see him?" "He was in a little box," she said. "How came you to know him?" The woman was named Mrs. Smith, and she explained she had gone to school with Charles back in Savannah. Gazaway Lamar was encouraged and vigilantly watched the horizon. Sometime later, Charles and two others appeared on a scrap of wreckage in the distance. As they approached closer, Mr. Gazaway saw his son Charles inside of a box with another man and a woman. Upon reaching the ship, exhausted, Charles collapsed into a deep sleep. When he regained consciousness, he asked, "Oh, Aunt Rebecca, what do you think has become of Mother and the children?" Holding back her own grief, she answered the boy, "I don't know. We must not talk of them now. But let us hope for the best, and try not to cry. You will waste your strength."
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually, right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
Two of the ship's lifeboats were successfully launched following the explosion. One of the boats was under the control of First Mate Solomon S. Hibbert and carried 11 people. The other was led by Mr. James Hamilton Cooper, and it held a total of 9 people. The boats pushed away from the wreck, and Hibbert picked up another 3 survivors from the water. With their boats full, they began rowing for shore. It would be a long, grueling journey. Exhausted, frightened, cold, and injured, they had no choice but to row for their lives. Along the way, A fireman from the Pulaski, who was badly scalded in the blast, succumbed to his injuries. He was solemnly placed overboard and sent to a watery grave. 13 hours later, the boats approached the breakers near Stumpy Inlet, North Carolina. It's a daunting task to row a boat to shore through breakers, and even more so in rough seas. The occupants were thoroughly exhausted and refused to row any further. With no choice, Hibbert decided to try getting through the breakers and set off. As his boat hit the crashing turbulence of waves, his boat was capsized, and 5 of the 11 on board drowned. 6 others, including Hibbert, managed to straggle on shore. Cooper, seeing the horror unfold in front of him, waited 3 hours, hoping the weather would calm before finally making his attempt. His boat, like Hibbert's, was capsized. Cooper, now in the water, felt someone grab his foot. Reaching down and finding a person's long hair, he grabbed and pulled up, finding passenger Mrs. Nightingale and her 7-month-old child who had been tied to her out of safety. The 6 survivors from Hibbert's boat provided assistance, and all on Cooper's boat made it to shore. In total, 16 people from the lifeboats made it safely, and they collapsed on a sand dune, thankful to be alive. After regaining their strength, they set out in search of assistance, eventually finding the property of Sigley Red of Onslow County. There, they received shelter, warm clothes, and food. On June 18th, the 16 survivors from the lifeboats were transported to Wilmington, North Carolina. Other passengers who could not board a lifeboat clung to wreckage, debris, and anything they could find floating in the water. Mr. B. W. Fosdick fashioned a raft of sorts by using wooden debris from the ship and cloth from 2 mattresses found floating nearby. Along with 2 other survivors, they perilously sailed toward shore. As winds increased on June 15th, the seas became very rough, and waves crashed over the 3 men and their improvised vessel. At 4 p.m. on the 16th, their raft reached the breakers at New Inlet and broke apart. However, Fosdick and the 2 others were able to make it to shore. At the moment when the promenade deck broke apart from the stern, a man named Mr. Merritt had lost sight of his wife and child. He managed to find them in the water, with his wife desperately holding on to their son. An unrelated child, a 12-year-old boy, clung on to Mr. Merritt. Merritt urged the boy to climb up on nearby wreckage and to hold on to his son. Returning to take hold of his wife, Merritt was suddenly grabbed by a large man in the water, panicked and desperate. Merritt, unable to break free of the man, pushed his wife away to set her free from the struggle. Merritt submerged himself and stayed under until the man was forced to let go. He found a hatch from the Pulaski and climbed up on it, and another man joined him. After a time floating on the hatch, they discovered a larger piece of wreckage and transferred themselves over to it. After a severe storm on the 16th almost capsized them, they made it to shore on June 17th. The barrier islands of North Carolina were very sparsely populated at that time, but Merritt found an abandoned fishing shack nearby and collapsed inside from exhaustion. When he awoke, 3 fishermen were inside with him, getting a warm fire going. Merritt asked about the man he was with, but the fishermen had not seen anyone else. Later, it was discovered the other man was found by a local farmer and given shelter. Sadly, in the chaos, Merritt never saw his wife or child again. Back on the wreckage of the promenade deck, Rebecca Lamar and others grew delirious, dehydrated, and desperate. It was Friday, June 15th. Over 24 hours had passed since the explosion, and the group knew they must leave the wreckage if they were to survive. A plan was devised to split the group into the 2 boats they were able to secure and salvage earlier. The smaller of the 2 boats was quickly filled with able-bodied men, and complaints arose among the rest over how to split everyone into the 2 boats. The larger of the boats was overcrowded, damaged, and leaky. A Danish seaman among them warned it would be safer to remain on the wreckage, and the boat would be capsized. Rebecca urged her brother Gazaway to listen to the man, but he insisted they push off. After rowing just 100 yards, it was clear the larger boat was in fact sinking, and both boats returned to the wreckage. When dawn broke on Saturday morning, June 16th, sailing ships could be seen in the distance, but the ships did not see them. A man named Captain Hubbard, a merchant seaman, suggested for 6 men to take the small, safer boat and make for shore, in order to send for help for those remaining on the wreck. Among the 6 men, Gazaway Lamar was urged to be included, because he would have more influence to obtain the required assistance. Concerned for his safety, Rebecca Lamar insisted he strap a pillow around his waist as a life preserver. Before the boat departed, the dead bodies which had been collected on the wreckage were removed, as it was sickening and demoralizing for the survivors to observe. One of the found bottles of wine was opened and passed around, one by one, to drink of. The small boat pushed away with Gazaway Lamar and five others, with all hope riding on them reaching shore. The boat made it to New River Inlet on June 16th, and Gazaway Lamar offered a reward of several thousand dollars to a local man, Captain Hatchell, to search for the remaining survivors. But the weather was too rough to make a rescue attempt. The men were taken in and cared for by locals John Wilkings, a Mrs. Powers, and her servant. Day after day, more of those on the promenade deck succumbed to the conditions. Hunger and thirst took their toll, and delirium was common. A passenger, Mr. Smith, fixated on a light in the distance and believed it to be a ship. Despite the protestations of others, Smith grabbed two scraps of lumber, entered the water, and swam off. He was never seen or heard from again. Young Charles Lamar believed he saw his dog, named Bosun, drowning in the water, and repeatedly went into the water after him. Each time, he was hauled up and comforted by his Aunt Rebecca. The 18 people who remained on the bow section of the Pulaski were all men, except a 12-year-old boy. Included was Captain Pearson, the sailing master of the ship. Using their ingenuity, the men were able to fashion the wreckage of the bow into a raft, and several more in the water found their way on. Using a makeshift sail, they attempted to guide their raft to the coast, very nearly making it before uncooperative winds blew them back offshore. For 5 days, the men suffered through the sweltering June sun and cold nights, enduring terrible thirst and hunger. Finally, on June 19th, they were spotted by a schooner about 20 miles north of New Inlet. The schooner was the Henry Camerden, commanded by Captain Eli Davis, bound for Wilmington from Philadelphia. Davis rushed to the raft, and upon reaching them, shouted, "Be of good cheer, I will save you." Davis brought the men on board and learned of the horrible tragedy of the Pulaski. The men also told Captain Davis of the large section of the Pulaski wreckage still harboring survivors, and Captain Pearson urged Davis to search for them. Later that day, on June 19th, 5 days after the blast, Rebecca Lamar, her nephews Charles and Thomas, and only four others were rescued by the schooner Henry Camerden. Of the 23 people who sought refuge on the wreckage of the promenade deck, six made it to shore, and seven were rescued by the schooner. All the others perished. In total, 33 people were rescued by the schooner. Out of this tragedy, a love story emerged. Following the explosion, a passenger by the name of Mr. Ridge had boarded the first lifeboat. He caught sight of a woman named Miss Onslow and immediately offered his seat to her. At that very moment, the ship broke apart, throwing them both into the water. Mr. Ridge was able to lash together two benches from the Pulaski and used it as a raft. As fate would have it, he spotted Miss Onslow once again, and they both clung to the benches. When Miss Onslow realized their raft would not support both of them, she said, "You'll have to let me go to save yourself." Ridge replied, "We live or die together." A passing lifeboat offered to take one of them on board, as they only had space for one more. Instead, they agreed to stay together. After several days adrift, the two pledged to stay together for the rest of their lives. When they were finally rescued, Ridge told his betrothed that he had lost everything he owned on the Pulaski, and she could leave him if she wished. But Miss Onslow would have none of it. The two were later married, and following the wedding, Mr. Ridge learned that Miss Onslow was an heiress to an estate of over $200,000, or about $7 million in 2024. Among those lost in the disaster were former Congressman William B. Rochester, as well as Gazaway Lamar's wife, Jane. Only his son, Charles, survived. Records of the time are inconsistent, but an estimated 64 people survived the Pulaski disaster, and 128 perished. Gazaway Lamar suffered from chronic depression and guilt for the remainder of his life. Rebecca Lamar survived the wreck and the ordeal that followed. She later married Hugh McLeod and published her memoirs of the Pulaski disaster in 1854, titled The Loss of the Steamer Pulaski, Much of the research for this episode was obtained from her account. A month following the tragedy, on July 7, 1838, a law was passed which would, quote, provide better security of the lives of passengers on board vessels propelled in whole or in part by steam. It called for all vessels to be licensed, receive biannual inspections, have a certified engineer on board, and have a hose and pump installed in case of fire. 14 years later, the Steamboat Act of 1852 required hydrostatic testing of boilers and boiler steam safety valves, and an early movement for federal maritime safety inspection began. However, it was not until 1871 that the Steamboat Inspection Service was officially created. The Pulaski disappeared into legend for almost 180 years. On May 9, 2018, Blue Water Ventures of Cove Springs, Florida, discovered the wreckage of the Pulaski, 40 miles off the North Carolina coast. Divers recovered 150 gold and silver coins, keys, wall sconces, jewelry, silverware, and the ship's anchor. Using 2024 values, an estimated $4 million of banknotes and personal items are believed to have gone down with the steamer. Among the items found was a gold pocket watch with the time frozen at 11:05 p.m., just 5 minutes after the ship exploded. But even today, the loss of the Pulaski is largely forgotten. A single monument to the victims of the steamship Pulaski can be found at Presbyterian Church on Edisto Island, North Carolina. That's going to do it for the steamer Pulaski, Lost in the Dark. Thank you so much for listening. You can read the entirety of Rebecca Lamar's memoirs and view images related to this episode at shipwrecksandseadogs.com. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can follow the show on social media at shipwreckspod or at shipwrecksandseadogs.com, where you can also find official merchandise. Check it out. Get yourself a shirt. It will make your friends jealous and you'll help support the show. Original theme music is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him on YouTube at Sean Secret or on the web at sean.siegfried.se. Please join me again in 2 weeks. But until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.